This conversation is all about analog, because that is the title of the new book by design historian Dejan Sucic, former director and now director emeritus of the Design Museum in London, which describes itself as the world's leading museum devoted to contemporary design in every form. The book's full title is Analog, A Field Guide, and it's billed as a celebration of all things analog, from the machines that made it work to the artifacts and the culture that they made possible. And so I'm fairly ashamed to say that I familiarised myself with the contents of the book by scrolling through a PDF. Although I see, Dejan, that the analog book will be available as an e-book as well. Is that disturbing to you?
I have to say that we have to kind of live with the fact that we are in a digital era. And the book is really looking back at what made it so special and what gives some people such passionate excitement to still make those highlights of the analog world still function. It's amazing how, you know, the great filmmakers still want to use celluloid. You think about Christopher Nolan, he talks about what you can get from a celluloid film, that those richness of colors that digital wipes out. We all know that vinyl records never really went away and are now coming back more and more. People love books and paper and the smell of ink. That's that sense of being able to touch things and hold them and own them is very much an analog experience. Owning a record is not the same as streaming, for example.
You describe the invention of the iPhone as a sort of mass extinction event for analog devices. Was it the smartphone that really turned things around?
The most picky kind of historians are quite awkward about what actually do we mean by analog versus digital. For me, it's that sense of it's a way of exploring how we record things, how we communicate things, how we measure them. And you'd have to say that clocks are hundreds of years old. The way that we measure with a ruler, it may be even 1,000 years old. Those are the early days of analog. And what got me really excited was those 19th century accelerations of those technologies that allowed us to record music, to transmit sounds over long distances on copper wires. How quaint is that? Take photographs using chemicals and silver and paper. And then we look back at those amazing people that really transformed those early versions of analog into something that was really functional. Eastman, who started the Kodak camera company, for example, he was the Steve Jobs of his day. He turned taking a picture, which had been virtually a scientific experiment, into something that anyone could do, which is exactly what happened with computing a century later.
The book is a wonderfully luscious experience of nostalgia, seeing all the different devices and their evolution over the years and some incredible design moments. Do you have a favorite among them?
Well, there's so many. I mean, I have 4 or 5 typewriters in my study, none of which I use, but I'm still fascinated by that way that they still represent, even now in the digital world, the typewriter is still the way into the digital universe. I'm thinking about the keyboard, which is this 19th century accident, the way that the keys are spaced out, Q-W-E-R-T-Y and so on, which is still the way that we communicate with the internet, with each other in this world. An accident of history, but a fascinating one. I love radios, of course I do, and I have more than I can possibly use, and I'm very anxious about the way that analog signals are being switched off, and some of those radios will become functionless. But looking at an early 20th century radio with those lost stations, Hilversum, Luxembourg, and you kind of expect, I don't know about the ABC, but you know, you expect BBC announcers to speak in the tones of the late 1920s, reading the news in a dinner jacket coming from these machines. Of course, they don't, but you know, you can't help but think about those times.
I must say, I was delighted to see the Erica von Cobra telephone as well, a very distinctive device with the sort of the dial on the bottom. What's the story behind that particular device?
I mean, the telephone used to be this piece of government-owned equipment that you never actually owned, that you rented. It was like an official piece of equipment, and the post office everywhere was very careful what you could do with it. And then consumerism started to infect that relationship that we had. So the cobra phone, and what a great name. You know, it looks like a rising cobra, rather more friendly than that. But the format of how you actually speak into a phone is so interesting. You know, each culture has its own different approach with a telephone. The Italians answer the phone even now by saying pronto, which means ready, as if there was kind of two servicemen on each end of a transatlantic cable communicating military information. In Britain, we used to start by reciting our telephone number and our name. It's kind of a very formal process. And that relationship that we have, that, you know, some people used to be really nervous about phone, and now another generation of post-millennials consider being telephoned some kind of insult. You know, it's the etiquette is all wrong.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dayan Sujic, who is the creator of The Field Guide to Analog, which is a wonderful compilation of all things analog, a genuine celebration. And Dayan, you mentioned one of the really big names in analog, Kodak. There's quite a few others that you explore in detail in the book. I was particularly struck by the observations you made about the role of the company Sony. Could you tell us about that?
Well, Sony was one of those amazing Japanese companies that emerged from the ruins of a burnt out department store in Tokyo in 1945. Its first projects were adapting Japanese wireless sets to get overseas stations. During the war, of course, there was a kind of presumption that you didn't listen to the other side. And they were the first people to license the use of transistors outside the US. They didn't quite manage to make the world's first transistor radio, but they probably made the second and the most efficient. And they spent the next 40 years developing what consumer technology could look like. They wanted the smallest TV. They wanted the smallest video camera. A fascinating series of products, which really created this language that, you know, Sony's managers were very keen that their products would be recognizable, that they would actually suggest modernity and progress at a time, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s, Japan was seen as a place which produced cheap and cheerful copies of other people's ideas, a bit like China 20 years ago. And Sony was one of those companies that said, no, we can actually innovate. We can actually show what modern object looks like.
You describe the pleasure of analog being both aesthetic and emotional. Could you unpack both sides of that a little bit for us?
Well, I talk about how the smartphone really was the trigger that doomed a whole range of physical objects to extinction. Your smartphone is your clock, it's your music system, it's your map, it's your bookstore, it's so many things, and offered so much, and yet also took away so much. That sense of possessions that we use to remind ourselves the sorts of things that matter to us. We don't own a wristwatch to tell the time specifically. We own a wristwatch to remind us of the person that gave it to us or the reason that we have it. We find an emotional resonance with objects that grow old with us, that show the passing of time, that show leather cases that look better with time passing. Those are all things that the digital world can't give us, plus that sense of ownership. And the digital world has wiped out a whole series of really interesting things. It's not just technology that made the long playing record, that 33 and a third revolutions per minute object with 6 3-minute tracks per side. That was about, you know, technology giving us what you could actually do on a recording, but it also created a new musical form. The long player was, in its day, the equivalent of an opera or of a symphony. It was a musical form. Streaming means that actually that carefully planned out sequence of musical tracks is no longer relevant. It's killed it off. It's also killed off another not so minor art form. If we think about album art, initially the record company sold albums in a plain paper wrapper. But in the 50s and 60s, it became this, as I say, not so minor art form. Andy Warhol did album covers for the Rolling Stones, adding a zip to Mick Jagger's jeans. Richard Hamilton, the great prop artist, did the White Album cover for the Beatles, turning it into a kind of unlimited, limited edition artwork by, in the first run of the albums, each cover was stamped with a different number, suddenly transforming. All those things have gone. How do we keep our memories from the digital world? How do we actually replicate that sense of being able to touch something, to control something? In the old days, we thought we were in charge of our machines. In the digital world, I suspect we think they're in charge of us.
You mentioned the resilience of vinyl in particular. When you look at the analog renaissance, are there common characteristics of the types of devices that tend to survive or bounce back, do you think?
researching the book, I was fascinated to find how many communities there are out there dedicated to restoring the least likely pieces of technology. Who remembers 8-track stereo now? It was the first car music system, I guess, with a system which was supposedly rather neat in that you didn't have to take the tape out and turn it over to hear the other side, but it did just change tracks halfway through each track, which was not so great either. I think the things that really have the power to survive are those which allow people to feel some sense of creative input. So analog film, for example, does allow people to take photographs. It's fascinating how Polaroid came back from the dead.
Mm.
Polaroid cameras, I guess, were the nearest that the analog world came to the digital, that it reduced that waiting period between pressing the button and seeing an image to just a few seconds. Of course, it's not the same as digital, but it actually allowed you to want to do more and more and more of that. So it's not a surprise to me that those instant films have come back.
Thinking back to, well, I suppose your ongoing role as director emeritus of a design museum, does the digitalization of everything make it harder to create an interesting museum experience when so many functions are crunched down into one small object?
I think it makes you think about what museums are for and why design is in them. As a design critic, some of these objects I'm looking at, I can remember when they were first launched. And as a critic, you find yourself going from writing for the news pages, as it were, to writing the obituaries of some of these products to try to explain why we talk about the history of design through a canon of things like clocks and typewriters and record players is pretty mysterious to another generation, which have no idea what their functional purpose was. I think it makes us really work harder to actually show what's relevant and what isn't.
Well, it's been wonderful discussing the classics of analog with you, Dayan. I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of real-world, tangible interest in the book, and I'm pretty sure there'll be a few digital copies sold as well. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Sunday Extra.
Julian, thank you, and don't forget to press that button.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.